I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
Cotton Avenue in Macon, Georgia, is a short street. It's only two blocks, really. Wagons full of cotton rolled down this avenue to the Ocmulgee River nearly two centuries ago, loading bags and bales onto the flat-bottomed barges. Short as it is, Cotton Avenue is also an emblem of our profoundly conflicted South in the 21st century. At one end, Rosa Parks Square, named for the African-American woman whose defiance of the Old South inspired the Civil Rights Movement. At the other end of Cotton Avenue, a statue of a defender of the Old South, a Confederate soldier. He's 10 feet tall with an enormous mustache. He's holding his rifle and looking northward over the river. So, in this corner, Rosa Parks. And in this corner, the Confederate Army. Welcome to the Deep South. Now here's something the white planters and the slave owners who made their fortunes on Cotton Avenue couldn't have seen coming. These few blocks would later be the center of black commerce in Macon, one of the first places in the city where African Americans built real wealth. In the early 1900s, it was known as the Black Main Street of Macon. Now, why am I telling you about Macon, Georgia, and about Cotton Avenue? Because that's where our story begins. It's 1962, and it's where boy meets girl, where they flirt, where they go for a stroll, where they're confronted by police, and where, in a few minutes, the boy, a teenager, will find himself on his back in the middle of a street, fighting for his life, not understanding what just happened. I'm Hank Klibanoff. Welcome to Season 2 of Buried Truths, which examines the stories and the histories behind unpunished, racially motivated killings during the modern civil rights era in the South. Buried Truths draws upon research and writing by students, former students, and me at Emory University in Atlanta, where I teach the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases class. It's there that we examine who we were, as a people, as a society, as a civilization. And we do that so we can understand how we became so divided by our racial differences. We examine a past when, across the races, we allowed so many misconceptions, fallacies, and myths about race to take root. Now, when my students look at that past, you know what too often they find? They find disturbing similarities to the present. It leaves them wondering, how far have we come? We're going to focus on the why of this tragic history. So we study the past because we believe when we understand who we were, we can better understand who we are. Every story has a soundtrack, and we can't really talk about Macon without talking about music. That river I mentioned earlier, the Ocmulgee, means bubbling or boiling water. So what was bubbling up out of the river in Macon in 1962? Rhythm and blues, soul music, rock and roll, truly immortal stuff. Otis Redding was raised here. Little Richard was born and raised here. James Brown recorded his first hit, Please, 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 at WIBB, a black format radio station, in 1955. Now, these three guys aren't just big stars. Rolling Stone magazine included all three of them in the 100 Greatest Artists of All Time. Three guys from Macon. James Brown at number 7, Little Richard at number 8, Otis Redding at number 21. So if you'd been on Cotton Avenue on the night of October 13th, 1962, you'd have heard that music spilling out of the Middle Georgia Veterans Club. Now, on different days, this two-story red brick building was host to veterans or scout troops, others. On this night, a Saturday, the club had opened its doors for a teen night, a party at which Macon's black teenagers could drop by, could meet, could be safe. That same year, that same month, October 1962, Otis Redding released his first big hit.
These arms are mine, they are lonely.
This song talks of a guy who really wants to be with a certain girl. He's falling for her. He wants her in these arms of mine. It's the perfect background song for a date between A.C. Hall and Eloise Franklin, the two teenagers at the center of our story.
I'm wanting you, and if you...
A.C. and Eloise arrived separately at the Veterans Club that Saturday night. A.C. was 17, handsome, athletic, and tonight dressed nicely in a crisp white shirt. Eloise was 16, very pretty and smart, and tonight in her best dress with stockings and black flat shoes. And after a while, they left the club. They stepped out into a surprisingly warm October evening there on Cotton Avenue, and they walked carefree under an autumn moon. Eloise had her eye on AC. A friend of hers explains why. Her name is Ollie Mae Hutchins.
She said that was her first love.
Her first love. If you drive on Cotton Avenue away from the river, it turns into Forsyth Street, and then it merges into Vineville Avenue. And that's where the second part of our story begins, at the Shrimp Boat Restaurant on Vineville. On that same Saturday night in October, 18-year-old Doris Hopper had just worked a 10-hour shift. She left at 9:15. And then drove the shrimp boat's delivery truck to her mother-in-law's house to meet her husband, Barnett Hopper. And there was Barnett's car right in front of his mother's house. Doris pulled the truck in behind it, and at this moment, everything changed. You know how when something terrible happens, you often think, wow, if she had just hit one more red light, if the timing had just been a little bit different, the terrible thing wouldn't have happened. Well, this was like that. If Doris had arrived home 15 minutes earlier or 15 minutes later, we wouldn't be telling you the story. So what happened after she arrived? Here's how Doris described it a few days later.
I drove up behind our car, mine and my husband's, and there was a colored man getting out of the car as I drove up. He walked behind the car when he got out, right in front of the lights on the truck.
Now, I have to tell you that that was a voice actor. And I have to tell you one more thing. Doris and Barnett Hopper, a white couple now in their 70s, are still living. They declined to sit down for an extended interview. I did speak with Doris Hopper on the phone for a few minutes in January of 2019. She was gracious, pleasant, even as she declined to revisit that evening. Later, I'll relate a few other things that she told me. But let's get back to our story. So Doris Hopper runs into the house to tell her husband Barnett that she'd seen a colored man, her words, getting out of his car.
He went outside and got in the car and the pocket was open and the gun gone.
The pocket, the glove compartment. That's where the Hoppers kept their black .22 caliber revolver. And now, it was missing. Barnett Hopper told his mother, call the police. Macon policemen Josh T. Brown and James L. Durden had been involved earlier that day in an unrelated and very unusual case that they'd probably have talked about for years, if nothing else had happened that night. Brown and Durden were rookies, on the force between 7 and 8 months. But they weren't kids. Brown was 33, Durden was 29. And earlier that day, get this bizarre little story, they'd arrested an 11-year-old burglar. The kid led them on a tour through town of 19 places he'd broken into. An 11-year-old breaking into 19 places. That's the kind of stuff that they'd have been telling other cops for years. But then the call came in from the Hoppers. About 9:30 that night, Durden was locking up a drunk when the radio sergeant called Brown and Durden. They needed to get to the Hoppers' house in a hurry. Look into the stolen gun. While Brown and Durden are headed to the Hoppers, let me add a few details to the mix. Brown and Durden were white. Macon, which with Atlanta and Savannah had integrated their police forces in 1948, had two black officers, but they were allowed to patrol and police only in the black neighborhoods. Brown and Durden made it to the Hoppers' house in 5 minutes. The officers asked Doris whether she could identify the thief if she saw him again, and when she assured them she could, Officer Brown did something that police officers almost certainly wouldn't do today. He asked Doris and Barnett Hopper to jump into the backseat of the patrol car and help them search for the man. Do you see that scene? Two policemen asked two civilians to hop into their cruiser and join them in searching for a man who's walking around with a stolen gun. Now, in my class, we paused on this. Finally, one student asked a simple, obvious question. Wait, the student said. So if they'd arrested the man with the gun, where were they going to put him in the patrol car? Well, the police officers would come across someone that they thought stole the gun, and they would pursue him. But they wouldn't be putting him into the patrol car, and they wouldn't be making an arrest. As the police began their search, A.C. Hall was still on that moonlight stroll with his girl.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
A.C. Hall was the only child of a single mother. Her name was Curly Hall. And she was about 20 years old when he was born in 1945. Her husband was a few years older and was a private in the U.S. Army, but he was long gone in AC's early years. And from then on, AC was pretty much all Curly Hall had, and she was pretty much all he had. Curly Hall worked as a maid for the Hervitz family in Macon. 6 days a week, she was at the Hervitz home by 8:30 a.m. and spent long days ironing, changing beds, cooking, serving meals. Around 7 p.m., she would catch a bus home to a neighborhood called Tyndall Heights. Now, one of the Hervitz children, Jan Hervitz Mann, was a teenager at the time, and she remembers Curly was always crisp, always clean, fastidious, and usually laughing. Now, you may have to listen closely here, but Jan says A.C. Hall's mother, Curly Hall, was very proud of her own home in Macon.
It was really pretty. It was a gray and white, kind of like a white porch on the front, but then it was next to a railroad track. And you went in, it was a little bitty house, but it was pretty. I remember she loved that house.
Curly Hall was also a strict mom.
I can see where Curly would have not let him do anything bad. She she would have been all over him. I feel like I remember that he wasn't a kid that was a troublemaker.
A friend of A.C. Hall's had much the same recollection. Young A.C. couldn't always come out to play or hang out with the other kids in the neighborhood. His mother kept him close.
What did you see his mother, how did she treat him?
She was very sweet, very nice lady. She also watched over him really close.
That's Newton Collier. Newt, a boyhood friend of A.C. Hall's, who still lives in Macon. And I want to tell you something about Newt. Music is in his blood. Newt went on to play trumpet for the 1960s duo Sam and Dave, who were rhythm and blues superstars in their day. And yeah, what you're hearing is their monster hit, Soul Man. Newton Collier went on the road with Sam and Dave for 15 years. But in 1962, he was a lot like A.C. Hall, a teenage boy with his life ahead of him.
And I didn't really see no father image. I didn't have a father, so that might have been our little connection to each other. We sort of like helped each other out, big brother type thing.
AC's mom, Curly Hall, didn't break under the challenges of being a single parent. She rose up to meet them. She loved her son, provided for him, taught him decency and responsibility. She sent him to school. She took him to church. And she made sure AC left the house looking his best.
He was always sort of dressy. I think his mother starched his blue jeans because they stayed clean a long time. He looked a little neater than most of us did. And he liked to take his collar.
You know, his shirt collar.
And wear his collars up high.
Newt also remembers A.C. as being a strong athlete, at least in basketball. Now, Newt claims he could beat A.C. in a foot race. But when it came to the basketball court, well, A.C. was the first of the group to be able to dunk the basketball. But A.C. was more than nice clothes and athletic ability. Vivian Butts was another childhood friend who grew up near the Halls. She and A.C. were part of a group that walked to school every day. She remembers a quiet, mannerly boy who never talked back to teachers and never, as far as she knew, harbored a mean or cruel thought. By the time they were teenagers, A.C. had become sort of a big brother figure to Vivian. When she talked about going out late at night to meet boys, A.C. was firm. He said, "I don't want you to be like that. You're not that kind of a girl." So a picture is beginning to emerge. A.C. Hall was raised, loved, and disciplined by a hard-working woman who was the sole breadwinner in their house. He was well-dressed always and competitive when it came to sports. Now, we don't have a clear picture of him as a student, but he was at least respectful to his teachers, and he was growing into a kind and thoughtful young man. My students and I struggled to learn about A.C. Hall, and that's why we talked with old friends. But it was still difficult to form a complete picture. One of my students, Angie Jang, put it this way.
Because he was so young, I mean, he passed away at the age of 17. That's a tricky age. That's too old for anyone to fully forget him and too young for anyone to fully remember him.
So let's go back to that date between A.C. and Eloise, the evening of October 13th, 1962. Eloise would later say that A.C. was walking her, and I'm guessing slow walking her, to a friend's house. They took a shortcut down Hazel Street into the George Washington Carver School. Now, this had been A.C.'s school from the third grade, and in the fifth grade, A.C. won recognition in the Macon Telegraph newspaper for serving on the school's beautification committee. The committee, the newspaper said, had done much to make our yards attractive. So now, even as he and Eloise, probably arm in arm, walked closer to the school in the dark of a Saturday night, A.C. knew these grounds well. The school was located in Tyndall Heights, where the teenagers had grown up. Here, the lifelong lessons in racial etiquette that applied in the white parts of town didn't apply. You know, the faces not to look at, the places not to go, the things not to say. None of that applied here, especially not tonight. AC and Eloise were invisible, except to each other. This fine autumn night belonged to them. As they walked, Eloise asked if they could stop for a minute. A clump of dirt had gotten into her shoe and, in her words, was worrying my feet. Beside the Carver School, she stood on one foot, holding AC's arm to keep her balance, and shook out the shoe. She had just put it back on when a car pulled into the little driveway alongside the school. The car's headlights swept the schoolyard. Suddenly, AC and Eloise lost their invisibility. The car was a Macon City Police Cruiser. It was in this moment that AC Hall ceased to be a teenage boy and became a target. So where are we? Let's take a look at the scene. On this October night, we've suddenly got six people who have arrived at the same location. I'll put them in three groups. First, the couple, AC Hall and Eloise Franklin, teenagers out for a slow evening walk. Second, the Hoppers, Barnett and Doris, they're newlyweds, by the way, who had called the police to report a stolen gun. And finally, the novice police, Josh T. Brown and James L. Durden, who went out looking for the thief with the Hoppers in the back seat. As the headlights landed on them, AC pushed Eloise into the shadows and told her they had to run. The police car was coming closer, but Eloise wouldn't run. Now the car was abreast of them. Now it was pulling ahead of them. AC took off alone, sprinting toward the police car, then overtaking it, then running out ahead of it. Why did AC run toward the car instead of away from it? That's a good question with an interesting answer. The more important question, why he ran at all if he had done nothing wrong, will take some explaining, but we'll get to both. The four people in the police car apparently didn't spot AC until the teenager ran alongside the car. As he flashed by, Doris Hopper exclaimed the two words that would set this tragedy in motion.
I said, "That's him."
And she would later say this.
And I recognized him immediately by his clothes and his build as the man I had seen getting out of our car over at my mother-in-law's.
The policemen and the Hoppers would say the police shouted warnings to AC to stop. But Eloise Franklin would testify she heard no such warnings or demands from the police. Regardless, AC Hall kept running, and the police kept chasing him with the cruiser. AC came to a dirt mound behind the school and ran over it. But when the police car came to the mound, the officer driving the car, Josh Brown, was forced to slam on the brakes. Even before they got out of the car, the officers pulled their .38 revolvers and started shooting. So wait a minute. They fired before they got out of the car? Why would they do that? And they didn't just start shooting. Listen to the way Officer Brown later described it, here portrayed by an actor.
I was shooting to the left side, just pulling the trigger fast as I could pull it. I wasn't hardly aiming, just pointing the gun at him and firing.
Now, why would he do that? Why would he just fire away so indiscriminately? Well, there's an explanation, and both officers used it, as many officers before them had, and many officers after them would. They claimed that A.C. Hall, in his headlong flight, suddenly stopped, turned back toward the police officers, and made a threatening move with his hand. So they're saying they felt threatened and fired in self-defense. Self-defense. Does that have a familiar ring? Haven't we heard that pretty often in other high-profile police shootings of black men and boys in the past, 5 years? The pattern goes back a long way, and not always involving police. In season one of Buried Truths, two white men shot and killed Isaiah Nixon, a black farmer, because he dared to vote. The white men said they were just offering him a job, and he pulled a gun on them. Well, even their own family doesn't believe that. But white police officers and others use that alibi so often and so successfully in front of white juries in the past that I call it a secret password. Would it work this time? So there behind the Carver School, in a few quick bursts, Officers Brown and Durden fired 38 caliber bullets toward the teenager. One of those bullets penetrated the heart of A.C. Hall. Eloise Franklin remained in the shadows. She watched A.C. and tried to figure out where to go, where to be. A.C. ran a little farther and reached the street, then collapsed onto the pavement. Officer Durden, pursuing on foot, said he saw A.C. fall to the street and drag himself up to a sitting position. Durden, still holding his gun, ordered the young man to raise his hands. A.C. did, for a moment. He had his hands up, and then he fell back onto the street. This time, he didn't get up. Even as A.C. Hall was being pronounced dead on arrival at nearby Macon Hospital, police officers scoured the field behind the school, searching for a gun. Now, their assumption was that A.C. Hall stole the hopper's gun, then tried to turn it on the police when they caught him. The officers searching the field with flashlights found a wallet, a deck of cards, a Social Security card, all belonging to A.C. Hall. But a gun? No. The next morning, shortly after dawn, the police returned to search in the daylight. They allowed Barnett Hopper to join the search. Now, are you like me, wondering, why is he inside the crime scene? Now, we don't know how long the police searched, but suddenly, there it was, a black .22 revolver, matching the description of the gun Barnett Hopper reported stolen. It wasn't even hard to find. It lay in the grass a few inches off a path that children took to the school. That made it a little surprising that the officers' flashlights hadn't picked it up the night before. But now, it was Sunday morning. And now, there was a gun. Coming up on Buried Truths.
They didn't just take you in, oh, we're sorry, we made a mistake. You can go home now, we're sorry.
The folklore is if somebody gets in trouble and they need to say the guy got a gun, the throwdown gun.
And Mr. Hallowell met me at the door. He said, Howard, there's going to be a proceeding for A.C. Hall.
Buried Truths is a production of WABE. Atlanta. We have a newsletter where you can see photos and documents from the case, as well as links to some of the things that were mentioned in today's episode. You can sign up for our newsletter at wabe.org/buriedtruths. Also, follow us on social media. We're at Buried Truths Podcast. And of course, as always, please subscribe if you haven't already and leave us a review. It'll help others find this show. If you have any information related to this case, write or send a voice memo to hank@buriedtruths.org. Hank Klibanoff is a former newspaper reporter and editor and co-author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Race Beat. Today, he's a professor at Emory University. The Buried Truths team includes David Bereswain, Richard Hallix, Catherine Dautrick, Marilyn Gwax, J.N. Berry, and Christine Dempsey. The actors in this episode included Sarah Hallix and Parker Singletary. Thanks to Emory University and its Centers for Digital Scholarship and Faculty Excellence. And another big thanks to the nearly 100 students who've taken the Civil Rights Cold Cases class that Hank Klibanoff teaches at Emory. And thank you for listening to Buried Truths.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary. But when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.